In 1924, Rudolf Steiner presented his agricultural course to a group of 111 farmers in Poland. Steiner spoke of an agriculture to heal the earth, and he laid the philosophical and practical foundation for such a differentiated agriculture. Biodynamic agriculture is now practiced internationally as a specialist form of organic. Steiner's course comprised just 8 lectures, presented over a 10-day period. The path from proposal to experimentation to formalization to implementation and promulgation played over a decade and a half following the course. It needs to be understood that in the 1920s chemical usage in agriculture were growing exponentially and concerns were starting to grow in the circles. In this episode I spoke with Douglas Fregg, director of Le Cave de Pyrenees, about what are the principles of biodynamic and how are the famous compost created and what is their intended usage. Lastly, we talk about what are the associations the specialists and consumers should know about.
To harness your passion about wine. Through this series, we will shine a spotlight on some of the different regions, processes and concepts that shape the fascinating world of wine. I hope you enjoy the show and your own journey looking into wine.
Welcome to Looking Into Wine. Today's guest is Douglas Fregg, director of Le Cave de Pyrenees, also marketing manager of Le Cave UK. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, I mean, for who doesn't know Le Cave, today we're going to talk about the principle of biodynamic. And Le Cave is one of the leading importer and advocate for this style of wine, biodynamic. What does biodynamic mean for Le Cave?
Well, I mean, the important thing for Le Cave is always that we have wines that represent really clearly where they come from. And we feel that biodynamics, when we have tasted wines which have been farmed biodynamically, then we get a clearer sense of place as a result. And I think it's because partly it is, as the name suggests, biological, like organic, but it's also dynamic in the sense that it's proactive. I know that's not what biodynamic means, essentially, but for us, it means having a close connection to not only the farm and the farming process and the community, and in terms of grape management, the vineyard, the soil, the sky, your animals. So it's this very important holistic philosophy. And I sort of like to believe also that, you know, the way we run our company for the past 30 or 40 years is as a sort of almost like an extended family. And I feel that biodynamic farmers, they have this connection with, you know, their community, but also with everything, you know, every part of their farm. And that's really important.
On the biodynamics and the Steiner obviously was the person, the philosopher who created everything. For me, what struck me was the fact that then I always think biodynamic goes back thousands of years, but then Steiner did it in 1924. And it was very, very interesting for me. It's only less than 100 years old, and yet it's really has taken all the world and everything. And what did he do and what was his idea?
In summary, in 1924, in response to a request from farmers and landowners who had noticed degraded soil, low fertility, deterioration of the health of their livestock owing to chemical agriculture and over mechanization, Rudolf Steiner gave a series of 8 lectures in Silesia, which was at that point in Germany, is now in Poland, which later became the basis of organic hands-on agriculture movements. And it wasn't like Demeter was founded then and there, that was a bit later. It's important to also know that Steiner, of course, wasn't actually a farmer. He was a social reformer. He was a philosopher. He founded a movement called Anthroposophy, say it right, which is a kind of sort of spiritual science. He was deeply influenced by writers such as Goethe, 19th century. He's a German romantic poet and philosopher, and Rosicrucianism. But after the First World War, because he was involved in lots of different things and had a holistic view of society, he founded things like the Waldorf and Steiner education schools, research anthropo- anthroposophic medicine and gave his lectures on biodynamics, which was right at the end of his life, actually. He died, I think, in 1925. What Steiner essentially was doing was he emphasized that methods, all his methods should be treated experimentally. So what he did was he gave his view on what organic agriculture should contain, and thus we have the eight or nine Steiner preps which are used. He established a research group called the Agricultural Experimental Circuit Circle of Anthroposophical Farmers and Gardeners, and between after 1924, after a series of lectures, this spread throughout the world to 800 members, and sort of formed the basis for Demeter. His ideas were taken even further by a guy called Eadhard Bartsch, who he founded a group to test the effects of biodynamic methods on the life and the health of the soil. And he developed the sales organization, which was eventually known as Demeter, which was founded end of 1927, early 1928 in Berlin. And thereafter spread internationally. It was quite big in Australia, in Oregon, and then obviously it was huge in Germany and Switzerland and throughout Europe. So Steiner, what he was doing was actually drawing on really ancient and traditional farming methods, the one farm approach, but he was investing it also with a bit of sort of the spiritual sciences, the farming approach was to do with manures and preparations. The spiritual side was that somehow cosmic forces were being linked in the soil. So that side of it was probably, it reminds me a bit of Eastern mysticism. But apparently it was a Western philosophy. So it drew from lots of different philosophical sources. But actually the farming methodology has been going on for thousands of years, basically. And like all farming, it's based on observation primarily, intuition, listening to what your plants are telling you, what your animals are telling you, and working effectively with nature and natural rhythms. So I think there was nothing unusual about that. I think what was unusual is that he took organic practice and he put it into a code, a very distinctive code that people could follow. And I think beforehand, people farmed organically. Of course, everybody farmed organically. But at that point, it was a reaction to this industrialization and mechanization in terms of farming. So the farmers and landowners who approached him wanted to know why is it the soils had no life, no nutrients, or whatever. So he was proposing something highly specific, almost like a holistic sort of medical approach. But he was also saying that this is, of course, you can treat the problem, but the main thing is not to have the problem in the first place. So in a way, to create a farm as a living organism, this thing whereby you don't need to do too much to it, but you need to bring it in balance. And his idea of balance was very important. And I think really appealed to a lot of farmers who really wanted some sort of instruction.
Yes, I mean, in the 1920s, early 90s, was also a time when chemicals were really going about and they were growing interest and using them, and they were used widely throughout the world. And so I can see why people that wanted to do something, why, how not to use them and what to do when they didn't want to use them anymore. And I think he came along and created this movement. He created this code, which now we're going to touch on. What he created is like 500 codes. So it was like the 500 to 509, 8?
Yeah, 500 to 508, although a lot of people just go to 507. But I mean, yes, the main ones are the so-called field preparations, which are 500, which is horn manure, and 501, which is silica. So those are the field preparations, and the 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 and sometimes 8 are the sort of the compost preparations. So the first two, I think, are the major ones, and it's what everybody knows about or has heard of probably. The other ones are a bit more obscure because what they give to the soil is sort of like any compost preparation. It's a little bit of this and a little bit of that, but the more preparing the whole vineyard organism 500 and 501. So 500 being a humus mixture, which is prepared by filling a cow's horn with cow manure and burying it in the ground roughly 40 to 60 centimeters below the surface in the autumn. It's left to decompose during the winter, and then it's recovered as used for fertilizer. So it's stored. And then basically the whole point is, if you're going to be specific about it, it should be the manure of lactating cows, which is richer in sort of like in terms of fertility. It should be cows that have grazed in and around the farm itself. So that's why he wants, and they should be grazing on grasses and soils and plants which have no antibiotics, you know, so healthy soils. So this, it's that circle of life here. So they take from the soil and they give back, but with greater amplification, because the cow horn itself is not just a symbolic thing. It has like the reason why cows have horns is they get their nutrients through their horns. Like 80% of their blood flow actually goes through the horns, which is pretty amazing. And a lactating cow, again, well, cow that's giving milk, her manure will be that much richer. And therefore, when the compost is done, when the manure is like put together, then it is of such strength that it can be diluted and then used as a spray. So,
okay. So then there are two ways to use them: either spray the compost by diluting them, or using them directly into the soil.
If you bury the cow horn, then you create a homeopathic spray. So you dilute it in water, you stir it, clockwise and then anti-clockwise, you know, to spread it. And then I can't remember how much you dilute it by, but you dilute it and then spray. And you spray, I mean, you're supposed to spray in the autumn, but you can also spray it in the spring. The whole point about biodynamics is to understand the sort of earth's rhythms. In the autumn, the earth becomes more dormant. It's about to come into winter. Things are falling. The energy is falling. That's why plants, like, you know, stop sort of like growing in the winter. So that's when you bury it, and then you unearth it in the spring, when the upward energies, you know, the forces of growth are pushing upwards. So that's the logic behind it, basically. So, and they also do it, they bury it on a root day, and if possible, they dig it up on a root day. I mean, weather permitting.
Yes, I mean, there is the part of biodynamic, there is the part of the compost, but there is also the cycle of the moon and the cycle of the earth and the cycle of the sun. What do they represent, and what is the thinking behind?
I'll come into that in a moment, because I think the bit about the manure is really important, the horn manure. So the reason why they use BD500 is to create stable humus. Humus is that like lovely brown, almost like spongy thing. So when you dig up, if you dig the soil underneath the grass layer in a biodynamic vineyard, and you smell the soil, it smells really sweet, and it's really, really sort of soft. The humus really soaks up water as well. Second thing is you get increased populations of bacteria and fungi, which are really important in the long term. You get increased earthworm population. The earthworms turn over the soil and aerate it, which keeps it healthy. You get good improved soil structure, again, very important for the long term. And finally, enhanced root development. So you're encouraging the roots to search further down for minerals and for water and nutrients as well. So you get them, you know, the subsoil structure is a lot more healthy when you're using the 500 than if you're using sort of chemicals, and you're just really giving the hit to the top level, and you create this compaction as well. And so, yeah, so that's the reason for 500 being used. And then 501 is what that is crushed powdered quartz stuffed into a cow's horn again, and then buried in the soil in the springtime and taken out in the autumn. And then it can be mixed with 500. It's usually prepared on its own. And then the mixture is sprayed under low pressure over the crop during the wet season and used as an antifungal. It strengthens photosynthesis because of the little quartz crystals, like in the sort of like reflecting the light, and enhances ripening. So these are they're complementary, you know. So they're not sort of they're actually perform the opposite things. One for the canopy, if you like, and one for the underground. So,
and the
said the moon and the sun, they're part of the whole sort of idea of biodynamic. And why is that? Well, I think the growers tend to use a planting calendar. Actually, all farmers use the Mariton planting calendar, and this is based on observation. Now, whether or not one believes about, you know, the moon going through all the sort of different constellations affecting whatever, but it's certainly good to have a sort of routine. And it's certainly, we know that the moon does affect whatever. How it affects, obviously there's like moistures and there's sort of stuff in the soil as well. How it affects that, we don't actually know, because there's not been any credible research done on this. And that's actually true of biodynamics, by the way, is there are a lot of critics of the more esoteric sort of ethereal aspects of biodynamics, and even of the composting, how effective it is, because the argument is that organic composting would work quite as well. But there's only been 20 years research, which in the scheme of things is nothing really, because you can't really research. You can research one farm, but you can't really research every farm. But I think every farm is like an individual. It has its own particular needs. So discovering what your particular farm or your particular vineyard needs or your particular animals need is something utterly unique to you. Actually, what Steiner did say is to test every proposition and to understand why it might work or why it might not work. He wasn't saying that these things worked. He was saying that he was imposing a methodology, but he didn't say it was scientifically proven that that would work or that would enhance the whole thing. So
it was interesting when you're saying some producers have different views of what they do, which one they do. And I think there is still this discovering, and each producer decide to do what product they want to do. And I think when I visited a few producers, you can see different approach going on and different. But it was for me, it was also interesting also in the preparation. There has been a different number of people with different ideas. You have Maria Thun have a different coding, a different style of the preparations. And I think it's all quite an holistic approach. But when we were saying about the deer bladder, what other ingredients do they use?
Okay, so, well, 502 is yarrow blossoms, which are stuffed into deer bladders. I think the deer bladder is optional, not compulsory. And then it's hung out to dry in the summer sun. Then it's buried in spring and then mixed with manure as a fertilizer. And the finished mixture is meant to stimulate potassium. You know, all these are primary elements, silica and selenium-activating bacteria, all of which helps the vines flower and fruit. So that's one thing. But it's a bit like if you look at microorganisms and you think, like, I'm going to blast the vine with lots of these nutrients, and they must do good. The 503 is chamomile blossoms, which are stuffed into the small intestines of cattle and buried in really humus-rich soil in the autumn and then retrieved in the spring. And chamomile is connected with calcium process and helps to stabilize plant nutrients, dampens down excess fermentation, and invigorates plant growth. So that's why it's there. Number 504 is stinging nettles, and they're stuffed underground and surrounded on all sides by peat. They have a relationship with iron, apparently. They develop sensitivity in the soil and help to stabilize nitrogen, which we'll come into later, and promote the formation of humus. Number 505 is oak bark, Quercus robur, which is chopped into small bits, placed inside the skull of a domesticated animal. Yes, surrounded by peat and buried in the ground near the rain runoff. And then it's got a lot of calcium in it, apparently, and it increases resistance to plant diseases and fungal attacks. Now, there's no way to prove like all these things, because how do you know? How can you prove that it does it? So if there were no, if the vines were really healthy, you could say, well, it's just the organic stuff, the organic composting that helps. But all these different elements help a little bit, but you can't measure how much they help. I think that's the difficult thing. Number 506, that's dandelion flowers, and they're stuffed into the mesentery of a cow, buried in the ground during the winter and retrieved in the spring. And dandelion is associated with living silica processes activates the light influences in the soil and helps to enable the interrelationships of nature to become fully effective. Sorry, I'm slipping a bit. Then there's valerian flowers, 507, which are extracted into water. And that has a strong affinity with phosphorus. And it acts like a protective skin and provides a blanket of warmth around the and over the compost heap. So all these things are added to, most of them are added to compost to sort of like make the compost richer and more diverse. And finally, there's 508, which is always I've forgotten about, which is horsetail. And I don't know what that does really, but it doesn't seem to figure. So it's generally the 7 plus 2 is 9, and then you know horsetail grows naturally anyway. So you know why they're used really is because they were used in traditional medicine, which is why Steiner said. So he's saying like you would use these in homeopathic ways on human beings. Therefore, you can use them on the soil because the soil is living as well. And some of the byproducts of using them on the soil are really useful. So it's like helping to fix the nitrogen and so on and so forth. So,
and obviously, I mean, when you're speaking about nitrogen, is one key factor of the biodynamic production and the key interest. How does that? What does it do, and why is it so important?
Nitrogen is plays a hugely important part in the health and the growth of all plants, and is responsible for the green leaves you see growing on them. It helps plants to photosynthesize, which is a process that involves using energy from the sun to break down, water and carbon, so the sugars are formed, and then these sugars are used for the plant. So you can see how important it is, and the byproduct of that process is oxygen. Nitrogen is one of the main components of amino acids, which form the proteins that plants need to stay alive. So too little nitrogen often results, you see in vineyards, withered leaves, usually yellow in color, which is symptomatic of a slow photosynthesis rates, whereas too much prevents other essential nutrients from actually getting into the vines. So that's why maintaining the right balance of nitrogen is an important part of growing a healthy plant. How you use it, if you want to raise a healthy plant and you don't have much nitrogen in the soil because of chemicals, well, you can simply add as much or as little you need, which can be delivered through, easy and cost-effective methods. The first way of doing it is just to add animal or plant byproducts to the dirt with which you're working. So hence cow manure, and you can use chicken manure and other manures, basically, or you can use plant-based solutions like alfalfa, which is effective nitrogen and phosphorus fertilizer. So all these things, and soy as well, you can do all that. So it's really important because you can tell when a plant is nitrogen deficient. I mean, your vine, you can just see it walking through the vineyard. So
when it comes to biodynamic, how do they combat against like some fungi or some problem that you might have, and how does a biodynamic producer combat it compared to a traditional or chemical led?
Well, okay, when you have fungal diseases and viral issues, that's usually a sign of really poor quality soils. So when soils are alive with healthy fungi, bacteria, protozoa, all those things, water infiltrates the ground better, holds the moisture longer, organic matter breaks down faster, nutrients are more readily available, and the vine roots penetrate deeper. So that's their medicine, if you like, or that's the way they're treated. This means that when there's really tough conditions, such as dry spells, the plants are able to cope with the adversity because there's much bigger supply of moisture and nutrients for them to access. And they are sort of structured, the vineyard is structured in such a way that it can access them. Then there's this thing, I can't even pronounce it, mycorrhizae. Okay, so this is a powerful weapon below the surface of a biodiverse vineyard. These are fungi. And how they work is they're little filaments tunnel through the earth, taking available soil nutrients and converting them into the enzymes into food for the vines, or actually yeast almost. So these fungi expand as they mature, connecting with all their surroundings, potentially hundreds across hundreds of acres, and creating a food web with balances. And this helps to strengthen the entire biome. Some feel that the symbiotic relationship to the vine roots is an amplifier or a describer of terroir in wine. So the aim is to enhance the health and vitality of the entire farm, both above
and below ground by stimulating these fungi through building the soil's organic components known as humus, which we talked about earlier. So humus is this, like, you know, when you pick it up, you just know it, you smell it, it's like sweet. It's like a sponge protecting the vines from flooding. It absorbs even torrential rains and releases the water over the time as, you know, drought protection, and reinforces the resilience of the vines. As humus builds in the soil, it creates another symbiotic relationship with the environment by also sequestering carbon in the air and converting it into food for the vines, and promotes further fungal growth. So this is really, really important. There's a really brilliant book I read called, perhaps you know it, called The Hidden Life of Trees by Peter Wohlleben. He's a German forester. He shows us that trees and forests around us are not just like lumber factories, just as vineyards are not grape factories, but are actually wondrous organisms, as complex as any animal. So trees are, for example, social beings communicating with each other through their roots, thanks to a fungal world wood wide web, it's called, like, that permeates the forest and even shares nutrients in hard times. And there's an interesting film which features a grower that we work with called Stefano Bellotti. Alas, he died a few years ago. And he said that basically that the greatest vineyards they have, like, they have several meters, like, let's say 50, 60 meters of root systems. But those root systems connect with other root systems of other vines and other plants. And actually, there's several kilometers of root systems feeding off each other, giving information to each other. And this is how we have complexity, but also strength and power in the vines. But since chemicals started to be used in vineyards, these root systems have been damaged. They've been damaged through, you know, heavy plowing. They've been damaged through you know, putting the chemicals onto the soil. And the roots don't look to go down. They look to come up to get their drug hit. So it is like giving drugs to an addict. And of course, this actually means that the vineyards are technically quite sick, because if you took the chemicals away, they would die, because they have no means of competing or combating illness. Or if there is a drought one year, or if there is a lot of rain another year. The vineyards that always perform best, invariably, and I've been following this for 20 years, are biodynamic vineyards. So, you know, in the worst vintages we've seen, like 2002 for rain and 2003 for drought, the biodynamic vineyards just do exceptionally well. You know, they seem to be in balance so much that the alcohol levels are lower in a hot year and or higher in a cold year. And I think it's to do with the fact that they work in this incredibly efficient way out of sight. So just because they're out of sight and invisible doesn't mean there isn't a lot going on.
CAV works with a lot of this producer. There is you mentioned earlier the Demeter. How much do you think is important? How what they do, and do you use it as one of the key factor?
Well, I mean, Demeter is the only really accredited body. I mean, there is Biodivin, but Demeter for the whole world. It's Demeter International. And then within Demeter, there are individual countries which have their own associations, like Demeter Austria, for example. And of course, to pass the Demeter test, you have to not only do the treatments, but you have to be pretty well from root to bottle. You know, the whole process is audited. So it's not just how you work in the vineyard, that's important. It's also to a lesser extent how you work in the winery. You know, so native yeast and, you know, sort of, you know, not using chemicals, but it's also, you know, there's an ethical dimension as well. And I think this is what biodynamics has become for me is, yes, of course, it's the Steiner preparations, and it's organic farming and whatever, but it's a lot more than that. It's not a fixed recipe or a prescription. It cultivates awareness, in the world around us. It's about working creatively with the land and the region and other growers. It's about bringing the farm to health, but it's also the desire to meet the needs of the people, you know, the earth, you know, which often extends just beyond growing food for growing food's sake. So biodynamics is never going to be as productive as like, you know, industrial farming. But actually, with climate crisis, it's much more important to have a sustainable model of a business. So most biodynamic initiatives seek to embody the triple bottom line approach, ecological, social, and economic sustainability. They take inspiration from Steiner's insights into social and economic and spiritual life, as well as his sort of farming methods, or, you know, as well as his agricultural remedies. Community supported agriculture, CSA, as well as biodynamic, was pioneered by biodynamic farmers. So actually being part of the community. And many biodynamic practitioners work with in creative partnerships with other farms, with schools, with medical facilities, wellness, restaurants, hotels, homes for social therapy, and other organizations. That was Steiner's vision, was to put the farm at the center of the community. There's nothing more important than like, you know, that. And so biodynamics is thus a radical concept of regenerative agriculture and a potential movement for new thinking, sometimes called new age thinking, but still there's nothing wrong with that. And practices in all life is connected with food and the land. So, and we underestimate that. We just think food is like something you can click your fingers and it's automatically produced. And we like the ease of like access, but we don't think of the consequences of this. Whereas biodynamics sees everything as cause and effect, and every decision you make down the line will have consequences. And I think that's really important. So there's a really strong ethical component to it. And that I find that particularly attractive. I mean, of course, I find organic farming attractive, but organic farming doesn't mean what biodynamics is. It doesn't frame this into a philosophy. And it just says, you shouldn't put that chemical in the ground. You shouldn't put that chemical in the ground. Whereas biodynamics is much more dynamic as a philosophy. It's sort of like it's trying to base itself in ethical thinking.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is one question I wanted to ask, and we were talking about the ethical things, and you're talking about that, and it's all very interesting. I think it creates a lot of this movement, and it's very good for the local for the community, but there is also the risk that some producer may use the word biodynamically grown as a marketing tool. Have you come across it, or what is your vision about it? Is there a risk?
I think there's a risk. There's always a risk that people are going to do that. I'm not sure who the risk is on. I always encourage people not to be hung up by labels. You call something organic or biodynamic or natural. What does it mean, really? I mean, I think when one thinks of biodynamic, one, people are fixated by two things, by the Steiner preparations, so-called Steiner preparations, and by the sort of moon and the sun and the stars and, you know, all the fancy stuff. But it's a lot, for me, that's not so important. Because, I mean, we work with growers who say, like, yes, I work biodynamically, but where my vineyard is, it's not a marginal area. It's really easy to produce really good quality grapes from super old vines. So I don't need to use, you know, preparation 503, 504. Why would you? Why would you if you didn't have to? That's the thing. It's only a guide. I think biodynamics, if you think about it, it was really to offset the worst of industrial farming. So if you're lucky enough to live in an area, in a region in which, you know, there has been no chemical agriculture, and, you know, we work with producers who say, yeah, well, I didn't, you know, I was biodynamic within, like, almost as soon as I planted vines, because there was never any farming around where they were. So they're just planting on virgin pasture. Okay. I guess to answer your question, it's really about, I believe the consumer has to do some work themselves. You know, it's no point reading a label, and it's no point just trusting Demeter or one of the 50 organic associations. At least with Demeter, it's pretty clear. You can access the website, you know what you get. Organic is meaningless because there's so many bodies that sort of certify it. So unless you're going to like read up all your time about it. So I always ask people to find out about, you know, where does it come from? Who makes it? How do they make it? Why do they do it that way? Not just a reflex to say, yes, I'm organic, or yes, that person's doing it in a biodynamic way. It doesn't tell the whole story. I'm sure there are people who are not certified, who work in a far more sensitive and even perhaps more extremely biodynamic way than some of the people who are. I mean, we know there are massive biodynamic farms, and, you know, and you wonder how they can be biodynamic on that scale, but some of them are, can, and some of them I'm slightly suspicious of. And I know there are a lot of people who will say, I use biodynamic methods, you know, so they probably use some of the preparations like 500, 501, or they often work by, you know, they rack on the full moon or the new moon, and they follow the Maria Tung calendar. They work with sort of according to the rhythms of nature. They have their own animals, perhaps their own sheep, or you know, they have a horse plowing or whatever it might be. So they take and adapt elements of biodynamics and organic viticulture, and they adapt it to their needs, which I think is a much more sensible way of doing it. They may not get the certification as a result, but they're honest to what they're doing. So we might describe them as using biodynamic methods, but we can't say they're biodynamic because that's a sanctioned term from Demeter. So if on our website we said biodynamic, I guess, and they turned out not to be certified by Demeter, then, well, we're not absolutely strictly correct in calling them that. But we know how they work, and that's the most important thing. So that knowledge.
I think, from a consumer point of view, if you love something, it's always encourage everybody to investigate about the wine and being curious about what they do and send out an email to the producer. And sometimes, most often, they do reply with some information. And you can always ask the shops. And I think the last question, Douglas, I wanted to check if you know why they were called the 500.
I don't. No, yes. And I'm not sure that Steiner did call them 500. So I don't know why they started 500. But yes, that's what they're colloquially called. Yes. Although, I mean, like 500 is more called horn manure than 500. But I mean, yes, but people just do it. And I haven't been able to find out why. I'm sure someone will tell me.
So, absolutely. Someone would know. Hey, Douglas, thank you so much for this half an hour. And it was very nice to chat with you. And again, Douglas, you work at Le Cave de Pyrenne, and it's very well established wine suppliers, I think, you worldwide at the moment, or almost. And thank you for your time. Thank you.
What a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode with Douglas Fregg of Le Cave de Pyrenne. It's always worth picking through their impressive portfolio. I know that you made it to the end of the podcast. Consider give us a 5-star review. You never know, you might receive a special thank you message from me. Also, a big shout out to Moshe, who runs a very informative podcast called In a Vineyard With. I particularly enjoy his episode with Justin Tesseron of Chateau Ponet-Canet in Pauillac. Remember, you can find the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, and iHeartMusic. And remember to tell your friends about the podcast if you're enjoying it. It helps the growth of it. And lastly, music produced by Samuele Di Nardo, editing and mastering by Tommaso Ascoli.